BBC Radio Scotland 11:30. Let's get a summary of the main news headlines this morning. The Queen has missed this morning's remembrance service at the Cenotaph in London as she sprained her back. The President of the COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow, Alok Sharma, has told us there's disappointment about the watering down of some of the wording of the climate change deal agreed in Glasgow last night. And the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, will meet her French counterpart this week to discuss the number of migrants crossing the Channel in small boats. So as we've been hearing this morning, an agreement has been reached at the COP26 climate summit, which has been meeting in Glasgow for the last fortnight. But whatever the detail of that agreement and however achievable the targets it contains, how realistic is it for countries in the developing world with limited central control to deliver on them, even with the best of intentions? Well, to discuss that, the foreign correspondent and photographer David Pratt's here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Quite a lot of disappointment this morning, David, a bit of anger as well about this Glasgow Climate Pact as it's become known. Have the Global South and developing countries lost out here, do you
think? I think they have, quite simply. And I think if you ask most of the delegates that, they would certainly endorse that, you know. And to some extent, there's no surprise there, because they've been losing out for a very long time, you know. I mean, like every story, there are two sides to it. And I think, on the one hand, you know, we've got this story of the sort of developed world, if you like, not coughing up enough money. We're already talking about, you know, any increase in the 100 billion or whatever. Is that going to be forthcoming? Is it really going to manifest itself? But on the flip side of that story as well, even if and when that money is provided, the question is, how does it filter down effectively to those that need it most, or the situations that require it most on the ground? And that's where I have considerable I have many reservations over what's been happening, but that's where I have considerable reservations. In the main, largely because of, you know, 40 years of spending my time in many of the countries that are most, you know, badly hit by climate change, and looking at the state of governance within those countries and the problems that they have. So while they have difficulties as recipients in terms of getting what they need, how they actually then use what they're provided with is a real question as well, because there are lots of complex and, frankly, in some cases, quite corrupt issues there. Because I think if corruption and climate change have one characteristic in common, is that they both impact the poor and the vulnerable most profoundly.
Yeah, and you've been on your travels recently to Iraq, haven't you? What were you hearing from young people there? I noticed actually a map this morning of areas of the world that will be really badly affected. Cities, and Basra was on it.
Basra has a horrendous situation at the moment, particularly the waterways around Basra, and you know, refuge and plastic and all kinds of structural issues. And you know, but you know, the upbeat side of that across Iraq is that I met a sort of young generation. The demographic in that part of the world is predominantly young, and many of those young people are not only aware, despite the fact of facing all kinds of political and other economic sort of issues, they're very aware of climate issues, the environment, green issues, call them what you want, and are actually actively engaged in it. I'd give you a small example. I came across a chap who, one of the favourite foods in that part of Iraq is something called maskouf, which is grilled carp from the Tigris. And it kind of, that you know, sort of passion for that died off because there's been problems with carp and pollution within the rivers and waterways within the Tigris itself. And I came across a young man, actually, when I was there, who was actually involved in helping clean up the Tigris, but also was actually nurturing carp along with others in vast ponds that they created, and reintroducing carp into areas and stuff like that. These are tiny little things, but they're indicative of, you know, a generation that actually is aware of what's going on around them. The bigger problem, of course, is governance, you know, and being able to challenge regimes like their own and many others across the world, particularly in parts of Africa and the Middle East or in Latin America, where there is corrupt governance, you know. And that I think is the real challenge here. You know, places with bribery, illegal gifts, kickbacks, you know, where big business buys into governance, asks authorities to turn the other way. When I travelled in Colombia years ago with the Embera, the indigenous people there in the rainforest, you know, there was a complex kind of labyrinth of bribery, paramilitary groups, corrupt officials, all of which resulted in the rainforest being damaged and, of course, indigenous people being hurt most, you know. So that is a complicated issue, no matter what happens here in Glasgow when it percolates down to the ground.
Yeah, and is there an interest... Is there money as well to for nations, particularly in the Middle East, who have become so oil dependent, to move towards things like solar? You know, is that something they're thinking about? That's a resource that they have.
They are. I mean, in some of the biggest oil producers, indeed, at the COP summit, you know, have invested vast quantities of money and investment in renewables. But at the same time, they know that there's so many jobs dependent and stuff. They're not going to turn the tap off anytime soon. It's a bit like the issue we had with coal at the moment, you know, which has been a key issue at the summit as well. So, you know, while they make these pledges and promises, you know, the reality on the ground is, as we found even from one of the delegates from the Marshall Islands who was talking about the impact of fossil fuels and stuff like that, is that they're aware of the jobs that are dependent, the fragile economies in these parts of the world. That's the terrible irony, isn't it, that many of these places that have such vast natural resources and ecosystems and stuff that, you know, those resources are in part their problem. They're a curse and a blessing at the same time. Democratic Republic of Congo is that kind of place, you know, in terms of the forests, in terms of coltan mining, in terms of the natural minerals that it has. These are huge problems. And I don't see that being solved in any way in the near time, in the short term, let alone in the long term, and not least given what's just been happening in Glasgow. I don't want to sound too pessimistic, because there are roots, you know, really positive things happening in the ground.
Well, a fragile win was how Alok Sharma put it. David, stay with us. We're going to pick over this deal a little bit more, looking back to the conference itself. Lucy Dunn is editor-in-chief of the Glasgow Guardian student newspaper, and she's been covering her very first COP over the last 2 weeks. Also on the line is Dorothy Guerrero as well, who's head of policy and advocacy at Global Justice Now. She first started going to COPs back in 2007, which I think makes you a veteran. And Dorothy, let's call you a very good morning. Thank you both. Lucy, good to see you.
Good morning.
How was it for you, Lucy, your first COP?
Yes, so this was my first time at COP, and it was a really both exciting and quite inspiring experience as a student journalist on a number of different levels. I was in the media centre, so around a lot of very high level journalists, and spent a lot of time with photographers from Getty Images to Reuters. One of them actually gave me their long lens when we were in the Obama remarks to take pictures, which was quite a strange experience. And even from the world leaders that were there, and being in and around that, as a student, you feel as though almost a bit of imposter syndrome being in the same room as some of these people. Although, interestingly enough, the starstruckness did wear off after a while. But even out with that, you know, like the Glasgow Guardian was very active just outside the conference too, and covered many of the protests that were going on in Glasgow. And the full team has been really fantastic in coming together for this.
Some experience for you.
Yes, it's like nothing like I've ever experienced before. And I'm incredibly grateful to have been accredited at the conference. Unfortunately, was probably one of the only sort of younger journalists there. I would say there was maybe one or two other student journalists, but it was a fantastic experience from that level.
Dorothy Guerrero, you're here with Global Justice Now. What was your reaction to the deal last night when you heard it? We've been speaking to you over the last few days. Was this what you were expecting to hear, Dorothy?
Well, if we would look at what has been said over the last 2 weeks, there was already an expectation that the agreement will not go far enough. But of course, it is still disappointing and depressing that we ended where we are at the moment. This agreement, the hollowed out agreement, if I will point it out, for all the lip service that governments, especially the dominant governments, the wealthy countries has paid, the big business and those governments did not listen. They have not listened. And so keeping the temperatures below 1.5 degrees is not assured. The climate justice movement in the streets of Glasgow, although showed that we can't also tackle climate change without a radical transformation of the global economy and reparations from those who fuel climate change to those facing its worst impacts. I have followed or attended 8 COPs since Bali in 2007. The key ones would be Copenhagen and Paris as well, and then this one. And what makes it special is that when we talk about how do we start with our just transition towards a low carbon economy, that needed finance. And we should remember that the basic principles of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is that of common but differentiated responsibilities and capacities. So that means the rich countries, the UK, for example, that built its wealth and prosperity on the backs of previous history of colonialism, have historic climate debt, and that means that the fair share of the UK should be bigger. Its finance contribution should be bigger, and those that came here as promises, I'm afraid will not go long enough. But the positive part is that we can go back every year, unlike the agreement in Paris, it's every 5 years. So the review, the annual review in yearly now is something positive.
Yeah, and Alex Sharma was saying earlier, you know, this idea, this criticism about coal, the phasing out, turning to phasing down. What did you make of that, Dorothy? Because Alex Sharma said, well, to phase out, you have to phase down. It's a start. But, you know, is it enough of a start? Should a percentage of reduction been put on that to actually make it mean something?
Yeah. On one hand, it looked like India, supported by China, did change the last hour or last minute of the negotiation, what will come out in the text. But let us remember as well, actually, it's not about gas or oil or coal. It's actually about national interests as well. What was not discussed here is that when we talk about coal, then we're also talking about the fact that many of the developing countries still rely on it. So without climate finance, you could not win them out of coal, because they need infrastructure, they need financial support to transition towards renewable energies. And then at the same time, by not focusing on other fossil fuels like oil and gas, then we're letting the big actors like the US escape as well. Actually, what is also interesting is the US is also using a lot of coal. So the language do matter,
but
at the same time, the national interests matter, because we still need to see the developing countries improve their economy. We don't want the many communities in the developing countries continue to be in the dark or continue not having energy. They are the energy poverty countries, and so we need to lift everyone here. And by lifting everyone, climate finance is important.
Okay. Lucy, going back to you covering this from a student newspaper point of view, what kind of things were you picking up from your readers and fellow students about the progress or not that was made here?
Yes, so I think that it's safe to say that the majority of students have expressed their disappointment and frustration over the past 2 weeks, and with some even anger, I'd go so far as to say, at the quote-unquote posturing that's happened at COP26 and the real disconnect between students on the outside and protesters and activists on the outside and some of the decisions that are being made on the inside. There's been a real sense of hypocrisy with, you know, the world leaders coming and flying over for the first 2 days and then leaving again. And for a lot of students in and around Glasgow, on a more local level, there's just been a frustration at how things have worked out in terms of the disruption that's caused. And some are asking, you know, for what, like for how much progress actually has been made. And we really need to to try and have the voices of, you know, more women, more Indigenous communities, more people that ordinarily don't get as big a say at the table. And I think there's a real frustration and a real feeling of injustice.
David, I wonder, just as a final observation from you, what your perception is of, you know, we there was an attempt, wasn't there, to include youth in this, to have Gender Day, to bring Indigenous people over to speak about the true impacts of climate change on them. But at the end of the day, was this just about those big decision makers?
No, I think it was about both. I think youth are playing a vital and crucial role. It's this generation and beyond that obviously will be impacted most. And I think they're playing a profoundly important role. But, you know, there is a thing called realpolitik, you know, and when it boils down to it, and loath as I am to say this, you know, we heard, you know, a contributor talk about national interests and putting national interests aside. Maybe I'm just a cynic. Maybe I've been around too long in terms of visiting these parts of the world. But, you know, I find it very hard to see governments putting national interests aside in these situations. It really requires a real leap in imagination in order to do that. And I don't see much evidence of that happening, you know. And on the other side as well, you know, it's all very well to say, well, the wealthy part of the world must give us more money, but that money must come with accountability. It must come with checks and balances. I know to some extent that includes money given in terms of tackling climate change to make sure that it's used wisely, effectively, and justly without it being corrupted, you know. But it is not happening anywhere near enough. The world is awash right now with donations being made to parts of the world that need cash to help them out, not just over climate change. Take Myanmar recently, International Monetary Fund giving hundreds of billions of pounds to help a COVID pandemic response there, and that money has virtually vanished. Where has it gone? That's the sort of thing that needs to be tackled if we're really going to make sure those on the ground benefit most.
David Pratt, always good to hear from you. Also, Lucy Dunn, Editor-in-Chief of the Glasgow Guardian newspaper. Thank you for coming in, Lucy. And also Dorothy Guerrero as well, who is Head of Policy and Advocacy at Global Justice Now. A big thank you to you all. Now, closer to home, achieving the sort of targets set by COP agreements is often easier said than done when the realities of life kick in. Last month, the Sound Festival in